From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Alp Esmer. He's a broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service. Our topic, the politics and substance of Turkey's foreign policy in the wake of June elections in which the ruling AK Party suffered a stinging electoral defeat. Our guest, Henri Barki. He's the director of the Middle East program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. That's a prominent think tank based here in Washington. Previously, he was professor of international relations at Lehigh University in the state of Pennsylvania. Henri Barki recently suggested that Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, who suffered a defeat in June parliamentary elections when his AK Party lost its majority in parliament, appears to be acting in a way to buttress his party's chances of winning new elections. He has delayed the formation of a coalition government and resumed military operations against the separatist Kurdistan Workers' Party, or PKK, a group with whom he had previously pledged to engage in peace talks. And after months of resisting U.S. pressure, Turkey has finally granted the United States permission to use its Incirlik Air Base to launch airstrikes against the so-called Islamic State, or ISIL, in northern Syria. What are the factors that have prompted this reversal of decision, as well as Ankara's resumption of military operations against the PKK? Is Erdogan using war for domestic political gain to prompt fresh elections? And what's behind the joint decision by Washington and Ankara to establish an Islamic State free zone in northern Syria? Heretofore, Ankara and Washington have had major differences regarding the most effective strategy to defeat ISIL in Syria. Ankara has steadily maintained that unless and until the regime of Bashar al-Assad is defeated, whose very existence fuels the growth of ISIL, any attempt to destroy ISIL and its sympathizers is doomed to fail. Well, we'll ask these and other questions of our guest Henri Barki. Before joining the Wilson Center, he taught international relations at Lehigh University in Pennsylvania. His most recent works include Turkey's Syria Predicament and Iraq, Its Neighbors, and the United States. Henri also served as a member of the U.S. State Department's policy planning staff, working primarily on issues related to the Middle East. And his opinion editorials appear regularly in a wide variety of international newspapers and magazines. And Henri Barki joins us here at the International Broadcast Center in Washington. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And I'm delighted to welcome Alp Esmer, my colleague in VOA's Turkish service.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure.
Henri, first, let's talk about Turkey's decision to let the United States use Incirlik Air Base to launch strikes against ISIL. You wrote an article entitled, What's Behind Turkey's U-Turn on the Islamic State? So what is behind that U-Turn?
There are essentially three arguments one can make. The first one is that there was a growing perception in Washington especially that Turkey was not doing enough to fight ISIS, that Turkey had become essentially, people called it a highway for jihadists coming from the rest of the world, from Europe, from the United States, from Central Asia, you name the place, jihadists coming, landing in Istanbul and making their way to Syria and crossing the border and joining ISIS, and that the Turks were not doing enough to seal their border. So there was this perception and increasing criticism in Washington that Turkey was not doing enough, and that was creating a strain in Turkish-American relations. But fundamentally, I think there was another reason, which is in many ways more important, and that is that the United States decided, starting in October of 2014, to partner with the Syrian Kurds. Now, the Syrian Kurds, it's a group called the PYD, which is a political party called the Democratic Union Party in Syria. They are very closely affiliated with the Turkish Kurdistan Workers' Party, which you mentioned earlier in your introduction, the PKK. And the Turks see the fact that the PYD and the PKK are intimately linked as a threat to themselves. But Syrian Kurds who live essentially on the border areas in northern Syria, areas next to Turkey, have proven to be the only effective fighting force against ISIS. And if you look at what has happened since October, is that with American help, American Air Force and American arms, the PYD has not only managed to defend its territory in the town of Kobani, but later on has succeeded in capturing territory away from ISIS. They took the town called Tel Abyad. In the last few weeks, they've taken more territory and they've managed to push I suspect. And it is important to realize this, because if you look at anybody else in the region, whether it's the Syrian army or the Iraqi army or even the Iraqi Kurds, none of them have managed to fight ISIS the way the PYD has done. And the United States and the PYD have essentially created this relationship whereby you can argue that we, the Americans, have become the PYD's air force, or the PYD has become our ground forces, if you want. And this combination has worked exceedingly well. The president said 2 weeks ago in a meeting at the Pentagon, when he was talking about the fight against ISIS, he said that with the proper allies on the ground, we have demonstrated that we can fight ISIS effectively. And obviously he was making a reference to the Syrian Kurds and the PYD. And in fact, the relationship between the Americans and the PYD has deepened so much that there is now a PYD officer who sits in the command center, if you want, of the United States, in the town of Erbil in Iraqi Kurdistan. And this is very unusual, because the Americans have never allowed anybody else to be in that room. This emerging and deepening relationship between the Syrian Kurds and the United States is what really has scared Ankara in taking action. And the fact that Ankara was not opening its bases against ISIS, the fact that it was allowing ISIS fighters cross its border, were the reasons why the United States essentially decided to partner with the Syrian Kurds. So in a way, Ankara, as a latecomer, is now trying to figure out a way to undermine that relationship between Washington and the Syrian Kurds. And Washington has made it very clear that's not going to change. The Americans are going to continue to operate with the Syrian Kurds. They will continue to do what they've been doing until now, because that has been successful. I think there's a third but less important reason why the Turks changed their mind. And suddenly I think the Turks realized that over the last few years, as ISIS and other jihadist groups have used Turkish territory to transfer fighters, inadvertently, they have allowed the creation of an underground infrastructure run by ISIS. Because if you think about, let's say, a Frenchman, an Englishman, or even a Pakistani knows not a word of Turkish, lands at Istanbul airport, and then somehow manages to make his or her way all the way to Syria and cross the border and join ISIS, you need safe houses, you need transportation networks. This is not the doing of 3 or 4 people. This is a major network. And the Turks realize that this network one day can turn around and hurt Turkey as much as it hurts everybody else. So that was a third reason why the Turks changed their mind. But I think fundamentally it's reason number 2 and number 1 that are critical reasons.
Before I turn to my colleague Alp Esmer, a quick follow-up, and that is, there's no question that ISIL or the Islamic State is a major threat, obviously, in the region. However, Ankara has maintained that it is Bashar al-Assad, his regime, his henchmen, his Iranian allies such as Hezbollah, that actually are fueling the rise of ISIL, and that if we do not concomitantly try to defeat them, and this is why it seems that Ankara has also been slower to join the fight against the so-called Islamic State, because they don't see this other strategy. Because if Assad stays, then ISIL will continue. So what about that argument?
I mean, the Turks do have a point in that when you look at the Syrian civil war, it arose because of the actions and the behavior of the Assad regime. They don't rail against Hezbollah, by the way, and they don't really say much about Iran either. They focus solely on Bashar Assad. They actually have a fairly good relationship with Iran. However, the basic argument that Assad is the prime reason why you have this kind of chaos in Syria is the correct one. The problem, however, is that if Assad were to go tomorrow, and this is a fear that you have in the United States and in Europe, that the only likely victors of Assad's downfall would be the jihadist groups. There are 2 major jihadist groups. One is ISIS, or ISIL, as the American government likes to call it, or Jabhat al-Nusra. And Jabhat al-Nusra is nothing but al-Qaeda. When you look at it from an American and European perspective, I mean, it's not that they want Assad to stay, it's that they are worried that it's these jihadist groups that will take over and perpetuate massacres on an amazing and incredible scale. And then you'll have a jihadist state right in the middle of the Levant. And that's the problem. That's why we can't seem to agree with the Turks.
All right, but the Turks and many other analysts have said long ago that the United States and the so-called friends of Syria should have done much more to have wiped out Bashar al-Assad with moderate rebels. When they didn't act, you left a vacuum for these Islamists to come in, ISIL and others.
I mean, I think that to some extent is an unfair characterization, because this is a war, this is a civil war in the Levant. The United States already fought a war in Iraq and suffered the consequences. It's very clear that this administration did not want to get involved militarily in another war in the Middle East. And you have to give this administration its due in this respect. This is a problem in the region. So why don't the Turks and the Iraqis or the Saudis or the Jordanians or whomever think this is such a big problem? The problem is, when the Syrian crisis started, everybody turned around and picked up the phone and dialed 911 to bring in Washington and say, you do something about it. But this is 6,000-7,000 miles away from our shores. We are done fighting wars in the Middle East. And in that sense, I think the president was right not to get involved.
Perhaps, but nobody, neither the Free Syria Army or anybody else, was actually calling for boots on the ground. They wanted political support, diplomatic support, and weaponry so that they could fight the good fight, that is the Free Syria Army.
Well, we saw that the Syrian army did not amount to much. I think truth is, without boots on the ground by some power or combination of powers, the Free Syrian Army would not have been able to stand up to Hezbollah and the Syrian army. Let's be honest about this. We've kind of romanticized the Free Syrian Army, which was, you know, at its most, what, 1,000, 2,000 people? And as much training as we could give them and as much arms we could give them, they were no match for battle-hardened Shia militias, battle-hardened Hezbollah militias. So let's face it, the only way Assad would have been overthrown is if the Turks or somebody else had walked into Syria and established a zone. But the Turks did not want to do it because it would have been very costly and they would have taken lots of casualties. And if I'm a Turkish leader, I would have done the same thing. I would have thought, why should I do it? Maybe I'll call the Americans. Maybe the Americans will do it. But clearly, nobody in the region got the message. I think there's one place where I think I would criticize the administration severely. The administration was never clear about what its intentions were. It never said, look, we are not going in. Understand this. It doesn't matter what the conditions are. We're not going to go in. You have to do it. And if you want to do it, we'll give you the political support. Something of that sort would have helped, maybe. But it never made it clear and always left the door open to people who thought if they put more pressure on the United States, if there were more casualties in Syria, that somehow the United States would change its mind. But it was very clear from the beginning that this president was not going to send a single soldier to the Middle East.
And one more point before we leave that, which is the so-called agreement between the United States and Russia to remove Bashar al-Assad's chemical weapon arsenal. We see now that while that may be good for nonproliferation in some ways, he's turning now to barrel bombs and chlorine gas, which are not technically classified as chemical weapons, and he's butchering his own people. But we'll have to leave that for another time. First, you're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Henri Barkey. He's director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Alp Esmer. He's a broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service. And this is a reminder that our PCUSA podcast is available for free download on iTunes. You can find the download by clicking on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow me on Twitter at Carol Castiel VOA or connect with us on Facebook. And now let me turn to my colleague Alp Esmer for some questions.
Yes, Mr. Barkey, I'd like to bring the question to why the U.S. government is not really clear about the objectives in the region. First of all, actually, when Turkey started to take part in this anti-Islamic State coalition actively with airstrikes, they have bombarded PKK targets 20 times and ISIS targets only once. And the U.S. government was asked about its position many times, and they have clarified that PKK is a terrorist organization. On the other hand, State Department spokesperson Mark Toner said they're making it clear to the Turkish side that they are not supposed to fire at the anti-ISIS fighters in Syria. But the thing is, there's no clear answer about Turkey's attitude and about its position towards the PKK and ISIS. And apparently the U.S. administration is worried about things are going out of control. But why officially the U.S. position is not clear?
I don't know what you mean by the official position not being clear. I mean, what Neses doesn't want is for the Turks to use this campaign they have against the PKK to attack the Syrian Kurds. The Americans are saying we are differentiating between the PKK, which is a Turkish organization, and the PYD, which is a Syrian Kurdish organization. So the United States has partnered with the Syrian Kurds, and they've told the Turks very clearly that you do not touch the Syrian Kurds. The problem, of course, is that there is a very strong relationship between the PYD, the Syrian organization, and the Turkish organization. When you look, for example, yesterday, there were 13 bodies that were shipped back from Syria to Turkey. These are fighters who died fighting in Syria with the Syrian Kurds, but they all are Turkish Kurds. And the likelihood is that they were all from the PKK. So there is, in a way, this is a terrible turn of events from the view of the United States, I'm sure, that the Turkey and the PKK have resumed fighting among themselves. And when the Turks attack the PKK, they are also, to some extent, attacking folks in Iraq, not in Syria, but in Iraq, who are fighting ISIS. In fact, when you look at Sinjar in northwest Iraq, in Sinjar, it's the Iraqi Kurds with the PKK, the Turkish Kurds, who are fighting against ISIS. So, but that's, unfortunately, this is a situation in which the United States finds itself, and it's very, very difficult to extricate oneself because Turkey and the United States are allies. The United States considers the PKK as a terrorist organization, and Turkey is at war with the PKK once again. And the United States has no other choice but to say, look, the Turks have legitimate reasons to go after the PKK, but don't touch the PYD, even though the two are quite linked. The U.S. hopes that somehow the Turks and the Turkish Kurds are going to figure out a way to have another ceasefire and for things to go back to the status quo ante of a month ago. Unfortunately, for domestic Turkish political reasons, I don't see that being very, very likely. So we are going to see that this is going to be much more involved. As you pointed out, the Turks actually did three raids on ISIS. They attacked three ISIS positions, I should say, and the first day, and they haven't done much since. It is conceivable that in the future they will do a little bit more because they would like to show the Americans that they are serious, that they are doing something on the ISIS front. But it is not the Turkish contribution to the fight against ISIS that the United States is looking for, because it knows very well that the Turkish capabilities, Turkish willingness, Turkish hit ISIS is actually quite limited. And what the United States wanted is access to all the bases in South and Southeast Turkey so that with drones and fighter jets, be able to attack ISIS positions quickly on the moment when they see ISIS folks moving. I mean, just to give you an idea, the distance between Incirlik and Raqqa, which is the capital of ISIS, is 250 miles, whereas the distance between Raqqa and Doha, where the American aircraft are based, is 800 miles. So it makes it impossible or very difficult for the United States to respond very quickly. Now, there are even bases that are even closer to Raqqa on the Turkish side. Diyarbakir, Batman, we don't know if those bases have also been opened up. I mean, there's reports in the Turkish press that Turkey is going to offer those bases as well. Maybe they have been already offered. I don't know for sure. Nonetheless, those bases would make it far more effective for the United States to fight ISIS. And what the United States wants to do is to be able to continuously, nonstop, harass ISIS to make life so difficult for ISIS that, A, ISIS has to essentially withdraw, give up territory, and use obviously the Syrian Kurds to help the United States get that territory. But eventually also the big prize is not Raqqa, but it is Mosul. Mosul is the third largest city in Iraq, and it has been under the control of ISIS for more than a year. And the whole Iraqi strategy of making Iraq whole again depends on getting Mosul back. And Mosul, again, is very close to the Turkish border. So the actual focus is Mosul, in my mind, and therefore the United States needed those bases. And it doesn't, at this stage, is going to worry too much about the Turkish PKK fight.
We'll be taking a quick break right back.
The lyrics could be French,
English,
Portuguese,
Bantu,
Arabic, etc.
It is the beat,
the African beat that counts.
The beat does all the translations.
It cuts across all languages and gives us the understanding that this is the African beat.
It is so distinct
and adhesive.
It binds us together.
African beat on The Voice of America, Mondays through Fridays, 0900 and 2000 Universal Time.
With David Bandy.
Back to Press Conference USA and our special guest, Henri Barke. He's director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. And we're talking about the role of Turkey in fighting ISIL. Well, Henri Barke, I wonder if you could clarify or try to help us reconcile apparently contradictory positions. Why is it that President Erdogan sees the Syrian Kurds a very important ally for the United States in the fight against ISIL, who is also an enemy of the Turkish state, one could argue, as more of a threat than ISIL itself? And what is the role of domestic politics at this very juncture when the government is unable to form a coalition in the wake of the June 7th elections? What is the role of domestic politics in all of this?
First of all, the Turks are wary of Kurds in general, because Turkey has a Kurdish minority of approximately 20% of the population, and they all, most of them, tend to reside in the east and the southeast part of the country. Although Istanbul has 2 to 4 million Kurds, we don't know exactly how many. Istanbul is the largest Kurdish city in the world by some reckoning. That said, when you look at the Kurds from a Turkish perspective, there are 4 groups of Kurds, but the Turks don't worry about the Iranian Kurds. They worry about Iraqi Kurds, Turkish Kurds, and Syrian Kurds. The Iraqi Kurds, who have now a federal arrangement in Iraq, have their own capital, their own governments. The Kurdistan regional government is autonomous. It's recognized by everybody. And that government, it has excellent relations with Ankara, because the Turks and the Iraqi Kurdish leadership have established quite intimate relationship, because the Iraqi Kurds are completely dependent on Turkey for access to the rest of the world, export of oil and gas, investment. I mean, Iraq is the number 2 or number 3 Turkish export destination. Most of that is accounted for by the Iraqi Kurds. So there is a very cozy relationship, if you want, between Iraqi Kurds and Ankara. And Erdogan feels confident that he can manage and he can dominate the Iraqi Kurdish entity because they're so dependent. The Syrian Kurds, by contrast, are not beholden to Ankara. The Syrian Kurds tend to be left-wing, tend to be much more independent. They're affiliated with the PKK, which the Turks consider as an enemy. So de facto, the Turks have looked at the Syrian Kurds as the enemy. And because the Syrian Kurds live on the border areas, and because the likelihood that after Assad is overthrown, whichever arrangement emerges in Syria, the likelihood that there will be a Syrian Kurdish autonomous region of some sort is threatening to Turkey, because then the Turkish Kurds will say, look, Iraqi Kurdistan is there, the Syrian Kurds have their own autonomous region, what about us? That's why, strategically speaking, Ankara is terrified by what's happening in the Syrian Kurds in Syria. And that's why they have continuously said that the Syrian Kurds are a greater threat than ISIS. And by the way, that saying, or that discourse saying that ISIS is less dangerous than the Syrian Kurds, has really rattled many people in Washington, because clearly Washington doesn't see the Syrian Kurds as an enemy, on the contrary, as a partner. And that has created rifts between Washington, Congress, and the administration, and the Turks.
Indeed. And of course, that's unfortunate, but it goes to Turkish identity. And it also flies in the face of the peace talks that Erdogan had tried to begin with the PKK. So it seems contradictory.
Well,
they were looking to, you know, also give greater autonomy to the Kurds, but they're sort of schizophrenic about their relationship with the Kurds.
The problem, unfortunately, is that whereas Erdogan does deserve credit for starting negotiations with the Turkish Kurds and with the PKK and the PKK's imprisoned leader, Abdullah Öcalan, it is because of these negotiations where the PKK announced a ceasefire. For the last 2.5 years, Turkey was very quiet. In fact, there was no fighting between the Kurds and the Turks. And the hopes that some kind of a deal would be achieved was actually quite high. Things started to deteriorate in October of 2014. ISIS surrounded the town of Kobani in northern Syria. Kobani is a Syrian Kurdish town, and a large chunk of the population escaped to Turkey. But the Syrian Kurds decided there and then that they were going to resist ISIS and they were going to fight back. And Erdogan and the Turkish government at the time essentially took the position that they would rather see ISIS defeat the Syrian Kurds than the Syrian Kurds resist ISIS. That was the beginning of a break between Turkey's Kurds and the AKP government. And in fact, I think that the major reason why Erdogan, the fact that he wanted, and he made it very clear, and that he rather see the town of Kobani, which became a symbol of Kurdish resistance, fall to ISIS, destroyed his relationship with Turkish Kurds. In fact, when you look historically, half of Turkish Kurds vote for parties that are associated with the insurrection, with the PKK, and the other half has always voted for Islamic parties because a large chunk of the Turkish Kurdish population tends to be very conservative. They tend to be very pious. They voted for a whole series of reasons for the AKP over the years. After Kobani, those Kurds shifted their allegiance to the Turkish Kurdish party, and that's why Erdogan lost his majority in parliament.
Indeed. Well, as we close, and I want you to address that, because you were recently quoted in the New York Times saying that Erdogan is going for early elections. So explain that a bit, particularly with respect to the gain in seats by the People's Democratic Party, the HDP, which is dominated by is the Kurdish party, which got a lot of support by other non-Kurd in Turkey, and it exceeded the threshold of 10% and enabled it to have a large number of seats in parliament. So now we're seeing that the prime minister is unable to form a government, and some are saying, including you, that perhaps Erdogan is gunning for fresh elections. So explain why that's the case, and do you think he will be successful in order to try to overturn the results of June 7th?
Look, that's a very difficult question to answer, whether or not he's going to be successful. But let me just say, you know, once the tensions started to increase after Kobani, you saw that things in the southeast, in the Kurdish areas of Turkey, were getting very tense. There was a bombing, in presumably done by ISIS, although ISIS has never claimed it, of young Kurdish activists in a town of Suruç. Suicide bomber killed 33 people. Immediately thereafter, two Turkish policemen were executed by unknown assailants, and the PKK claimed responsibility for it, which, whether they did it or not, doesn't matter. The fact that they claimed responsibility was essentially a sign that the ceasefire had ended. And in many ways, what the PKK did, by killing or by claiming responsibility, was to play right into Erdogan's hands, because that gave Erdogan the excuse he had to go after the PKK militarily. And by doing so, and when you look at the Turkish press and what's going on, because most of the Turkish press today is either controlled or influenced by Erdogan and his party, Turkish press is on complete war footing against the Kurdish party, HDP, because the idea is, and that's why I think there might be new elections, is by associating HDP, a new, very charismatic leader, Selahattin Demirtas, with the PKK and with the violence, they hope that by calling new elections, that that party will fall below the 10% threshold. If you fall below the 10% threshold, you don't get any members of your party into parliament. You may win a district, but because you haven't made the 10% national threshold, your candidates don't get into parliament. So it's the other party, and in this case, it would be the AKP candidates would make into the parliament. So the strategy is to force HDP below the 10% threshold, in which case Erdogan's party will win an absolute overwhelming majority. I think HDP has 80 seats. 60 of those seats at least would go to AKP. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to figure it out.
So he's really playing the nationalist card. Henri Barki is the director of the Middle East Program at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Henri, thank you so much for your time and terrific insights.
Thank you.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington, and joining me on the program was Alp Esmer, broadcaster in VOA's Turkish service. And I'd like to thank Anna Zalewski for booking our guest, and our engineer was Curtis Bynum. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.